Hey, y'all, today is a big day, right? I mean, the game of games, right? The Blazers tip off at noon, right? Not so much. Not so much. That's not exactly the game of games. And I think I resisted praying for success for our friends down in Atlanta, the team that is from Atlanta. Notice not a moan in the room, because you all are done. You're done with New England, right? Sorry, Ray. I'm so sorry. Ray didn't even get up and leave. Hey, somebody told me, you know, Pastor, if we get up and leave suddenly, it's not your sermon. I hope. But it's because there is rain in, or snow in the forecast. Rain, duh. Snow in the forecast, right? How about that? Okay. Can I tell you one more little piece of news? It's my mother's birthday today, so if you see her, she's not in this service. She'll be in second service unless she gets snowed in or something. But, you know, love it up for her, would you? That's cool. I want to talk to you about something that the words fateful decision are descriptive. And they're going to weave their way through not only what you and I read in God's Word today, which is where they come from, where the idea comes from, but they are a description of your daily life and mine. We have fateful decisions that we face on a regular basis. And I would define them simply. If you're taking notes, please write this down because it will drive everything you hear, hopefully from me, but more importantly from God. This morning, the fateful decisions are decisions that have great significance and consequence. Okay? A lot is riding on your decision. That's a fateful decision. To have foam or no foam on your latte, that's not a fateful decision, right? Who cares? Well, I do, for the record, but it's not a big deal. Paper or plastic at the grocery store? No big deal. Chevy over Dodge? Now we're getting warmer. We're getting warmer, okay. Should I marry? And if so, who? Well, that's a big deal. Should I restrain myself sexually or involve myself in premarital intimacy? Huge. See how it's going up in importance? Foam or no foam? What I do morally before I'm married? Big deal. Deciding to ditch a disabled U.S. Airways jetliner on the Hudson River in January of 2009 is likely the most fateful decision that Captain Sullenberger will ever make in his life. Sully's fateful decision, by the way, how many have watched the movie? Oh, wow. Sully's fateful, and that's a correct label for it, his fateful decision it resulted in saving all 155 lives on board. A fateful decision was made with enormous consequence. That's the idea here. Now, I was thinking about that before we get to Exodus. I was thinking about how that works in the Bible, and I found page after page in every book of the Bible, in fact, this picture is presented of people. People like you and me faced with choices. And many of their choices shape outcomes that extend vastly beyond the years, the short years of their lives on earth. Let me give you the first example. You didn't have to turn far in your Bible to find it. You know where I'm going, Genesis, right? So Genesis, by chapter 3, Adam and Eve are the first people to face a fateful decision. The decision, of course, that they made was wrong. They were told, stay away from a certain tree, do not eat it. Its fruit, that is. And they went to that tree, and they made a fateful decision, and it has affected every human being that has ever lived on this planet ever since. Their wrong decision. In the words of the New Testament, which are written to assess the fateful decision that Adam and Eve made 4,000 years earlier. Look at Romans 5, verse 12. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through who? One. That brings it all the way. You can almost hear this sucking sound, like a vacuum that goes. Here's where it happened. Sin entered the world, Romans 5, verse 12 says, through one man, and death through sin. It resulted in spiritual and physical death. And in this way, death came to us all, you and me, all people, because all sinned. And in case we think we're the exception or exemption to that, Romans 3:23 says, no, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. You want a great statement to write down. John MacArthur said this, everything in a believer's life is an opportunity to glorify God. Okay, I'll let you take inventory right now. Your job, your relationships, your health, good or bad or somewhere in between. Everything in a believer's life is an opportunity to glorify God. So a question that I asked myself when I read those words and I think about fateful decisions, do I live my life that way? Seeing my life as a series of opportunities, some big fateful decisions and some very small, but opportunities on a daily basis that come to Steve to make choices that glorify God. That's how I thought it through. And I guess I want to ask you, do you live your life that way? Where you will start out, forget tomorrow because we're not there yet. You're going to live today. Mindful of the thought that everything that comes your way is an opportunity for you to glorify God. Now, please don't make a mistake that's tempting to make, especially if you sort of put your life against the Bible, of saying, well, you know, that probably applies, but mostly to prominent people, you know, the ones that are in the Bible, but not to people like me. It just can't quite work the same, can it? Well, consider that some of the most memorable counsel, and I didn't have to dig very long to find it. Some of the most memorable counsel in the Bible was given not to prominent few, but to all. Consider these words, to Israel, as they were wandering in the wilderness, which lasted a long time, 4 decades. Okay, as they're wandering in the wilderness, Deuteronomy 30 is written almost on the last day. It's the eve of them on the east side, eastern shore of the Jordan River, the banks of the Jordan. They're about to cross over into the land. And Moses says to them, this day I call heaven and earth as witness against you that I have set before you life and death. Can you say formidable decision, fateful decision? Life and death, it doesn't get bigger than that. I've set before you life and death, blessings and curses. And look at, it all hinges on this. Now choose life. Faithful decision. So that you and your children may live. That is not given to a few elite leaders of Israel. It's given to all the people and spoken to all the people. Another quick example. To all of Israel now settled in the land, Joshua says, they've been in the land, they've insufficiently taken control of the land, but at the end of Joshua's letter bearing his name, Joshua 24, verse 15, once again, puts a fateful decision in front of the people. Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Anybody know how that verse goes on? He tells his choice. As for me and my house, I've already made the choice. We're going to serve God. Still one more. I thought I would throw it your way because if you were here back in the day, we were studying the prophet Elijah and then Elisha after him. You know that we talked about a really watershed sort of moment, a fateful decision moment. When Elijah looked at the people and said, y'all got to get on one side of this deal or the other. You got to decide to go all in for God or, his words, go all in for the devil, Baal, the false god of the day. And he says it this way to all of the people in 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 21. How long will you waver in your decision between two options? If the Lord is God, and inferred there, of you, then he gets everything, right? Go all in. You know, I've decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. No turning back. So to state it again, every decision in every believer's life is an opportunity to glorify God. Now, like the one facing a young couple in the opening chapter of Exodus, if you haven't opened your Bible yet, go to Exodus chapter 1, and you're gonna meet a couple that you probably aren't terribly familiar with. Their names are Amram and Jochebed. That help? You know them better as mom and dad to Moses. That help? I think so. Now, to appreciate the weight of their fateful decision, allow me a couple moments to reconstruct the circumstances that led to the decision that resulted in them being inducted into the Hall of Fame in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, with these words. By faith, notice they're not even named in Hebrews. Isn't that something? They're not mentioned here, and they're not even mentioned in the passage in Exodus that we're going to read this morning. You have to dig a little further in a genealogy about 15 chapters later. So trust me, this is their name. By faith, Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed, insert those there. A double dare you to spell them right. But anyway, Moses' parents, hid him for 3 months after he was born. Because they saw that he was no ordinary child, and key words at the end of this, they were not afraid of the king's edict. So that sets us up to appreciate what we're about to read. As you locate Exodus chapter 1, second book of the Bible, let me have you just look back for a second to the end of Genesis 50, okay? So our last study together in this series, By Faith, which is following all of the Famers, the Hall of Famers in Hebrews chapter 11. So that's the tie-in if you're new in our study. Moses is next up. But before we get to Moses, we get to talk about his mom and his dad. Amram, his dad, his mom, Jochebed. Okay? So our last study, we considered how Joseph, though horribly mistreated, in fact, there's a sermon I preached that I've heard more feedback than most in a while, which is, it was called Don't Go Dark. And we looked at Joseph's life. He's a classic candidate of somebody that got the shaft. I mean, he got ripped off and could have easily gone dark. But he didn't. And the sermon title was Don't Go Dark. I'm just telling you that. If you weren't here, go to the church website and you can find your way in media there and find the sermon Don't Go Dark and you can kind of catch up on it, okay? But he never went dark despite his mistreatment. He stood out in biblical history, in fact, all of the Bible, as someone who suffered terribly. And this is the hardest part. I'm not done with my sentence. He suffered terribly for doing good. That makes me kind of go upside down a little bit. And yet he was convinced. Genesis 39 tells us that four times, that God was with him as he suffered terribly for doing good. He lived to see God make something, in fact, good out of many things that had happened to him in his life that weren't in any way good. Okay? Now, starting with that understanding, now let me state a summary of his life that is near the end of his life, and it's kind of part of the fame of Joseph in the bottom of the ninth. He says in chapter 50, verse 20, "You meant this for evil, but God meant this for good. All this mistreatment for doing good, you had bad hearts," speaking to his brothers and others. Potiphar's wife, for example. It's just part of his story. "You meant all that for evil. There's no question your motives. You wanted to wreck me." Am I getting close to how some of you feel in some circumstance right now? Man, these people, they don't like me. That neighbor, she doesn't really like me at all. My family member, they turn their back on me. Is that your story? Can I tell you something? I'm not making this. This is not made up stuff. This is real time right now for people I know and love and pray for. Stuff being done is done for the purpose of hurt and harm. But his words in verse 20, "You meant this for that, but God had higher purposes." Good. And words I found very helpful. "Whatever happens to me, I expect God to transform it into something good." If you didn't write that down when I shared it a few weeks ago, I think that's what was lodged in Joseph's heart. Whatever happens to me, it's almost like a bad sneaker wave hit him, and then another one, and then another one. Whatever happens bad to me for doing good, I expect, I sort of have this bias for blessing. I expect God to transform it into something good. Amen? That's just huge. You know somebody right now that needs to hear that. Don't just tell them like a pep talk in the locker room at halftime. Tell them because it comes out of the Bible in Joseph's life and his story. Now, Genesis then ends with Joseph dying, and his brothers and their families continue to live in the land of Egypt. Not their home, Israel, next door, north and east, Egypt to the west. And they continue to live there, and for quite a while, they prosper. Because of God's blessing, the remaining sons, 11 of them, and one daughter, Dinah, grew their families and their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. 400 years of that, and their numbers now had grown from a family of 11 bros and one sister to over 2 million people. That's the kind of prosperity that they enjoyed. And they're not home. They're in Egypt. Okay, you with me? So, along comes a new pharaoh or two. Pharaoh is kind of a name for a president. You think president. There's not just a pharaoh. There was this pharaoh and another one and another one. And frankly, not everyone's agreed on which pharaoh we're talking about. But it was the newest pharaoh, and he had no appreciation for what Joseph had done for Egypt, because Joseph kept people alive in Egypt during horrible years of crop failure and famine. They stayed alive, and in fact, neighboring nations came to them for food. That's more backstory. So this new pharaoh, 400 years later, didn't know all of that, had not connected that dot, or couldn't care less. Maybe it was a version of, "What have you done for me lately?" I don't know. But he comes to a place of saying, these people bother me. They make me nervous, frankly. He gathers his inner circle and says, hey, we got a problem. There are more than 2 million of them. We got to do something to contain them and control them because that could bite us in the end. And so they decided to enslave them. And they badly abused them. And now chapter 1, verse 6. Let's just read a little from the text in Exodus. Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing, that's my point earlier, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, these Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they're going to join our enemies, they're going to fight against us, and then they're going to leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses, which are two cities to store supplies in Pharaoh's Egypt. Verse 12. But the more they were oppressed and the more they multiplied and spread, so the Egyptians came to dread them, these Israelites, and they worked them, and he says it twice in the text here, ruthlessly. That means they laid it on them, and when the people began to moan and groan and plead for mercy, they laid it on them some more. Look at verse 14. They made their lives bitter and harsh with labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptian worked them, there's the word again, ruthlessly. Don't tell me your problem. Get to work, Jew. That was the kind of tone that carried the day. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, I feel like Puah, you know, like I'm a Marine or something right now. But he says to these two, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. And then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous. They give birth before the midwife even arrives. Probably not true. Verse 20, so God was kind to the midwives, these two, Shiphrah and Puah, and the people increased and became even more numerous, and look what he did for them. And because of the midwives' fear of God, he gave them families of their own. Adding all of that up, verse 22, the Pharaoh gave this order then to all the people. Every Hebrew boy that is born to you must be thrown into the Nile, but let every girl live. He is a monster, I tell you. And we have just now read the stage that has been set for a deliverer. Please understand, this ban against Hebrew boys was real and terrifying. This is not just a sort of a plot twist. This was a horrible place to be and live. In fact, if you were a married couple, I got to thinking about this. It's kind of a double whammy. As horrible as that sounds, on the Hebrew side of it, your entire posterity, your sense of continuation as a McCracken or a Jones or a whatever your name is, depends not only on you having children, but who? Boys. So you conceive a child and you hope, you don't have all sonograms, all that stuff to let you know ahead of time. You conceive a baby and you hope like crazy, in fact, that they're a son to continue your family line. Nevertheless, these two people, Amram and Jochebed, have three children. By the time Moses arrives. He's the third and youngest. They have an older daughter. Miriam is her name, 7 years old. And a middle child, Aaron, is his name. He's 3 years old, roughly, at this time. So, so much more we could say about these two, Shiphrah and Puah. Please understand, the king's edict that we've read is very clear. He started with just those two, and then he expanded it because it didn't work with them and said, everybody is in on this now. So the king's edict's clear, and they defied the king's order, verse 17 says, anyway. They knew exactly what they were told. And we've read it already, but God blessed them for doing so. Which just in passing calls attention to a principle. And that would be fearing God and following his authority takes precedence over all. Over all. When another authority, it doesn't matter what authority is in conflict with God, respectfully reject that authority and humbly submit to God. That's a whole other sermon. I preached on that before. The New Testament covers that in great detail. But we must move on. So it's into this context I wanted to spend time to help you appreciate the I can't breathe feel that chapter 1 brings. That this ancient couple in chapter 2 risk it all. Look with me just a few verses here. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. And she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, three-month-old babies don't quietly nurse and go to sleep. They start to be conspicuous. So she gets a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. And then she placed her baby boy in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister, Miriam, that's Moses' sister, Miriam, stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds, that is, Pharaoh's daughter saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent one of her servant slaves to go get it. She opened it, the daughter opened it, and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. And please note, these are important words. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. It wasn't, oh, what a cute little baby. Oh, my goodness, I wonder who he belongs to. This, it's noted here by her, by an Egyptian daughter of Pharaoh. This is a Hebrew baby. Then his sister asked, this is Moses' sister Miriam, watching all of this, comes forward at this moment, verse 7, and asks Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Probably no yes word was more important to Miriam than this word. Yes, go, she answered. So the girl went, got the baby's mother, which is Nobody got her name down, did they? Moses' mom. Jochebed, there we go. Okay, good. So Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you to nurse your baby. It's cool. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter and he became her son. She named him Moses, which means I drew him out of the water. Okay, I don't have time to get all the obvious risks in focus. You could get your own list, but I made a partial list. Looking at this story, the baby could be a boy right from the beginning when they decided to conceive. Likely, the edict that went out after Aaron was born. So Miriam wasn't under that necessarily. Aaron wasn't. Moses for sure was. And they knew that. That he could be a boy. It's not clear that they knew that these two midwives had, Shaphra and Puah, had defied the king's edict. They could conceal his gender no longer, another risk. We can't hide our son. The day of reckoning is upon us. A fateful decision is before us. Notice, too, the basket. Bit of risk there, I would think. It's this basket boat that could sink easily and drown their baby. Another risk. Whoever discovers the baby in the basket may very well comply with the king's edict, because that's how chapter 1 ends. The edict went to everyone. Look, the midwives aren't doing it for me. Everybody's deputized. Do away with the boys. Huge risk that whoever found this crying baby in a basket may in fact dutifully do what they were told. How about the heart of Pharaoh's daughter? No one could have predicted that one. And even in view of the fact that she saw it was a Hebrew baby. You see how many incredible known risks? There's more. Pharaoh's daughter could reject any suggestion by Miriam, who moves in at that moment and says, "Hey, I've got an idea." She could have said, "No, that's nonsense," and rejected it out of hand. And then if you fast forward to when the baby Moses is weaned, what are the chances that when Jochebed brought the baby back to Pharaoh's daughter, that Moses would be raised as one of Egypt's sons and would still be able to remember his roots and his purpose for life? All of those known risks. There was a huge wall of worry that mom and dad had to climb over. Yet a fateful decision was made by them to do just that. The epitaph that credits them and includes them in the hall of fame that I mentioned earlier in chapter 11, verse 23 of Hebrews, is that they didn't fear, they were not afraid of the king's edict. That's big. As a result, God appointed Moses, his appointed deliverer of the people, was born. Two nearly nameless people, Amram, Jochebed, put it all on the line, and as a result, they're immortalized for their fateful decision. We'll get to Moses next week, but the Bible insists that we pay attention to the role his parents played by faith. All of this foreshadows, of course, another couple. And they, too, are forever esteemed for a fateful decision that they made. It also involved a son and the bringing of that son into the world. Only his assignment was to deliver people from something much greater than just physical slavery. From the enslavement that comes from sin. His name's Jesus. Sent from his Father in heaven and born of a virgin, he's saved by his parents, really, of a genocide, and a weird twist by going to Egypt for a time. See, so many connections. And the fact is, he fulfilled a purpose that no one else could fulfill. You say, what is that, Pastor? He delivered us from our sin. 1 John 4, verse 10 says, this is love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as a covering for our sin, to take away our sin with his sacrifice. He is our deliverer, the Bible goes on to say in Colossians 1, to rescue us from the dominion of darkness. That's a deliverer. And to bring us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sin. I don't know the big and small ways this will all work out in your life, but you see two examples and you have before you a picture, a visual of how the sacrifice of Jesus delivered you from your sin and me. I'm going to invite the servers to join me at this time, and we're going to bring you communion this morning and give you some time to thank God for obviously the fateful decision that his earthly father, Joseph, and his mother, Mary, made. But to thank him for something deeper and more personal in your life, the deliverance that he brought. The means by which you were transferred from the domain of darkness to the kingdom of light. From the enslavement to sin and Satan, as the Bible puts it, to the freedom and life of Jesus Christ. And in this moment, I want to encourage you to hold the bread and the cup until everybody's served, and it'll give you time to kind of look at what those two things mean. They've been given to us long ago as a reminder. The Bible tells us that Jesus on the last night, he had a dinner with his disciples. And he said at that dinner, this is my body, which is for you. It represents me. The bread represents me. He just picked up a piece of bread at the table. He went on and then he took the cup of wine in that day and he took a sip from it. And he says, I want you to take this every time you do and remember me. It's my blood, the blood of the new relationship that my death will provide. A means by which you and I can commune forever. So take some time as you hold on to these. This is nothing new. We've done this before. But consider the fateful decision that his mom and dad made. And maybe in the moment, maybe you'll hear the Holy Spirit say to you, now here's the courage I want you to have to face that decision in your life, whatever it happens to be. Let's share in this moment together.